So I thought I would take a moment to wax poetic here before I started in my talk. I said I think that nobody has remarked, at least as I heard yesterday, nobody has remarked on the fact that, you know, where we're sitting right now in cosmology is in the CMB and it's obviously being a pretty remarkable place. A couple of years ago, you know, we didn't really know much about the CMB and anisotropy, and we were all skeptically flying each other, playing detections, or fighting each other, saying that maybe your instrument wasn't quite perfect or whatever. But gradually, we've learned that there really are three-tailed anisotropies. We various experiments saw the rise with Fasttune and Python and QMAP and all those. Other experiments saw low power, high L with Viper and Ogro, things like that. And then the peak with TOCO, and now we're getting images with you know, with Boomerang and Maxima and Daisy. And I can't imagine somebody wanting to leave this game at this point and move on to anything else. So you know, sort of like leaving the party as the cake comes out of the oven. So I think that we're in an amazingly interesting time in CMB, and I think that it's going to hold this for us.
Next year, I thought that was a farewell speech.
So you have to kick me out, Claude. Kick it straight.
Yeah. So anyway, I'm gonna speak about. Well, I thought I'd talk about the work. So here's a list of people who were involved in the B98, the LGB goings on. We also share a lot of technology and with Maxima, of course. So we had a very beneficial crosslink with them. Note that this is an international collaboration with a large contingent in Italy and also in Canada now, as well as various other places around the world, especially at Caltech, which is another place in the world. So I'm going to try and show you some things that you may not have seen yet in terms of the Boomerang data and things that we've been looking at in it. I'll just show you some pictures in case you haven't looked at the website to orient people on what the instrument looks like. It's, of course, a balloon gauntlet, so it's fairly large, weighs about 3,000 pounds, has a primary mirror, which is similar to the in size to the Maxima mirror, for instance, to give a similar angular resolution. One of the big differences is that our mirror doesn't move. They use their mirror to move back and forth on the sky into a rapid chop. We decided just to bolt our sound to the gauntlet and move the gauntlet back and forth. So this is a picture looking down the pipe of the mirror. In fact, you can see the image of one of the cryostat windows inside right here where the photon would bounce up into the cryostat. Similar to the Maxima experiment, we have re-imaging optics at 2 Kelvin inside there to act as a nice baffling place to catch all the photons that might want to do bad things there, spilling over the secondary and tertiary. All this stuff right here is shielding to try and keep away the sun and the ground away from the optics. Really, the only optic we have outside is the primary, so we want to keep it really well shielded as well as the scouting viewer underneath here. The other thing that this serves for us is that we observe looking away from the sun all the time, and this entire section out here, including this entire scoop out in front of the instrument, is kept in the shade so that it's thermally stable. If we point near the sun, in fact, we start getting really big offsets as the temperatures are driven up and down on this thing. So we definitely stay away from the sun at all times to keep on that power. Our focal plane actually has a mixture of technologies as a way to make it, spread your wrist around, I guess. We have two technology things here, separate types of things going on in the focal plane. These guys right here are single color. We have them at both 90 gigahertz with 18 arc minute resolution and also at 150 gigahertz with 10 arc minute resolution. We have two at each frequency in the focal plane. So that's where two of the 150 come from. It was one of these guys right here that was reported with the power spectrum in Nature. It was one of these single modes here, similar to what's being done in the bottom. The other frequency information, the high frequency information, comes completely from these three color photometers right here, where light gets split off into 400, 240, and 150 gigahertz bands. So when I show you maps having to do with the 400 gigahertz and the 240 gigahertz, they're coming from this band right here. We have four of these in the focal plane as well. So this is gives us a total of 4 times 3 is 12, plus 4 is 16 pixels, or 6 pixels ultimately at 150 gigahertz, which is our glory channel.
How does the optical efficiency
change? This one's got a little bit better optical efficiency than this one at 150 gigahertz.
So your EDC is
No, I'm not, but we quote the NET in nature is around 170 microkelvin root seconds or something like that for this guy. And this one's a little bit worse. It depends on the channel, you know, roughly speaking, low 200s or 200, something around there. All these sensitivities, we're writing an instrument paper right now where all the sensitivities and everything will appear. Okay, to show our real picture of what it looks like physically, unfortunately this thing doesn't exist anymore. We've ripped it apart. This entire thing right here is about a foot long from front edge to back edge here. The entire thing is cooled to 0.3 Kelvin, or actually 280 millikelvin for flight. The bolometers live inside these little cavities right here. This is one of those three-color photometers, another one over here, and then the signal mode of 90 and 150s are right here and here, and then there's a mirror image set over on the other side. In fact, we have two clusters of pixels in the focal plane, a split focal plane, mostly because the filters that we could get from Peter 8 only came up to a certain size. There are also historical reasons for splitting the focal plane like that for potential other analyses that we could have done in case our primary analysis strategy didn't work out. And this is what the bolometers look like, very similar to the ones that were using Maxima. Only difference is that ours are optimized for a higher temperature, and because of the higher temperature, we don't get quite as much sensitivity as the Maxima bolometers. The bands we chose are, of course, spread out to try and distinguish from various foregrounds. The 400 gigahertz channel is there purely as a dust monitor. We don't expect to do any CMB work with that. The 240 gigahertz is probably going to have contributions from both. In fact, what I'll show is that off the galactic plane, it looks like it's dominated by CMB. 150 gigahertz is our glory channel, where things are probably going to be cleanest. The 90 gigahertz channel is also dominated by CMB off the plane, we think, but is unguarded towards lower frequencies. It also has a larger beam, 18 arc minute resolution here, 10 arc minutes here, and actually the resolution of these guys are a little bit worse, sort of a order of 13, 14 arc minutes. This is the atmospheric spectrum at float, and this just shows where we placed our bands with respect to that. You can see that, that we probably shouldn't have much atmospheric contamination in the bed. Since everybody else has shown it, I have to quickly flash it. The Sigmarkian plot of L versus frequency, and this blue square is about where we operate it from 90 to 400 gigahertz. We've got information of L sort of a few tens up to, well, right now we've reported L of 600 or something like that. You can see the range of these dots up here. But it's a pretty good place to be working with 3D. We do find there's balloons. I thought people might find it amusing to look at this picture to get an idea of what the balloon environment looks like. This is taken through a telescope. This is not our balloon, but a different balloon. This tells you why people who are hanging below the balloon don't observe the zenith. The top hat experiment, which is going down there this year to ride around the continent, is placed up here. So they're not going to look at the ground, but that's a pretty good idea. They're going to be able to. And because of that balloon and also the ground emission, we have our experiment only observed between elevations of 40 degrees and 50 degrees. During the flight, we observed at three distinct elevations, 40, 45, and 50 degrees. In order to spread out our sky coverage and declination, also to get overlapping maps so that we can test for whether things look the same as the elevation. You've probably seen this before, but there's our picture, 10 and a half days around, at about 120,000 feet altitude. I'll actually show you an altitude plot in a minute. And we did have satellite connection with the whole thing during the whole time, so we were able to watch the data come in and actually optimize our observing strategy and look at things like how things were going during the flood. We did make changes in what we were doing as things happening. Our scan strategy is just to sit. We don't have any moving optics at all, except for moving the whole telescope. So we sit at fixed elevation for hours on end and just scan back and forth in azimuth at this fixed elevation at about plus minus 30 degrees or 60 degrees on the sky. Okay? And as we do that, the sky rotates. And this sky rotation leads to a cross-linked scan pattern that looks sort of like this. Okay, and what you see here is that this is 22 and a half hours of scanning at fixed elevation during the flight. It leads to this cross-linked pattern here from which we make the map. Of course, the scan period here, depending on our chosen scan speed, we operated at two different scan speeds, 1 degree per second and 2 degrees per second. So you can imagine that it takes an order of 1 to 2 minutes to go there and back all the way across the scan. Luckily, the CMB signal is actually, we're not going to be interested in the larger angular scales in terms of determining the power spectrum. So the CMB signal is on much smaller angular scales, and our instrument is stable over those scales, so we're able to make the map with those fancy map-making algorithms, similar to what Rodney just talked about, and Andrew will talk about them more in a few minutes. We had a 10.5-day flight. You can figure out how many hours that is. I can't do it on the fly up here. But, you know, roughly 190 hours of CMB observations in six different modes, really. Two scanning speeds, three elevations. We spent a long time looking at various galactic sources. I'll show you some pictures from those. And we spent a long time doing systematic effects, doing things like full spins, scanning back and forth across the galaxy. This is what it looked like when it came down. This was a nice soft landing. The cryostat was broken, but we've got it fixed up now and operating, and we're playing with it right now. If you want to see it, it's over in the lab. Well, not whatever. Here's what the sky covers look like in RAND. As you can see, given the three different observing elevations and the sky rotation and everything, leads to about 30 degrees of coverage in depth. Daisy is observing now, probably just right down here in this black area, so that they can't possibly compare with us.
No,
just kidding. So,
so you're right at 60. So,
yeah, we got.
Okay. We got to make sure
this would be very nice. This is the IRS map right here, and you can see the galactic plane. You can see that we spent some time looking at sources in the galactic plane in various places. So that tells you where the galaxy is going through here. And of course, we avoided it. The reason we didn't go far over here, there's great sky over here, but over here we start getting pinched by the sun. Because we can only go to about 60 degrees anti-sun before the snout of our experiment starts getting in the sun and we'll start getting this big thermal driven offset. So that's why we don't have more coverage over there. We're going to the results for the power spectrum report, of course, comes from the center of this.
What's that?
Oh, that's the actual data. The coverage on the sky, because we have this funky scan pattern, or rather because the sky rotation gives us this scan pattern which concentrates coverage at culmination and anti-culmination, or whatever you want to call it. Here's actually in units that don't bother paying attention to the top color bar units because they're wrong. In terms of the sort of integration time per pixel, you can get a rough idea of what we're looking at here. It's not uniform on the sky. There are these bands of high coverage that are caused by the fact that you see this culmination where all the scans are very linked together. So we have these high coverage regions. Those are at the various elevations and things. All depend exactly what latitude you're at, et cetera. And also, we have turnarounds here, edges of scans, and stuff like that. That's why we tended to analyze in the center of the map. The entire recorded piece, the signal of noise is going to be higher than one. I understand there was a discussion yesterday about calibration, and so we want to show you explain to you how we calibrated, and show you or explain to you why we think that our calibration is not entirely ridiculous. As we're scanning back and forth on the sky, we talked to somebody beforehand and arranged to have the CMB dipole arranged such that as we scanned back and forth across the sky, we were seeing a big gradient. Okay, so you could imagine that we could have been scanning equatorially on the CMB dipole and not seeing much of anything at all. But in fact, it turns out that there's quite a large signal, a few millikelvin, across our scan. And so we took that and made a very coarse map of this thing that appeared in our data. And here's the coarse map right here. Here's the predicted CMB dipole. And we, of course, just fit the amplitude, and here's the residual right here. Right? So this is basically where we get our signal. Now, Adrian showed a time stream of the KV dipole signal. Here's a time stream of ours, back and forth across the sky. The blue curve is a predicted or a fit CMB dipole, and this is actually after filtering. So unfortunately, I grabbed the wrong plot. I don't have one that's a residual. But you can see that it's a pretty darn good fit. It's phased up very well, and so it really does look like we're truly looking at the CMB dipole. We have two scan modes. Okay, one of them is at 1 degree per second. One of them is at 2 degrees per second. The deal is that this one right here, this is the 1 degree per second scan rate. At this rate, things were very clean, and we weren't driving pendulations of the payload very much or anything like that, any thermal variations on the cold stage, that kind of thing. And things looked very clean in terms of the dipole and the signal in this channel. When we doubled the scan rate to 2 degrees per second, we started getting actually signals that were larger than this dipole and didn't look phased correctly and didn't reproduce the right shape, that kind of thing, in the 2 degree per second data. This is the fundamental reason why right now, in the Nature power spectrum, we've only reported the 150 gigahertz power spectrum, the 1 degree per second power spectrum, right? We are very successful in taking that data and removing this scan synchronous thing by regressing out the 400 gigahertz channel, similar to the way Adrian was talking about. And then, in fact, fitting a dipole to it and getting the same amplitude for that regressed out fit dipole to within about 10% of this guy right here. The dipole appears at different frequencies in the two sets of data because we're scanning at twice the speed. So the fact that we're able to come and do this at in these two different data sets at 1 degree per second and 2 degrees per second and come up with the same number to within roughly 10% is where fundamentally we come up with our guess at our systematic error on the calibration. Okay, so we are getting our calibration number off of the CMB dipole, and we get our uncertainty on that based on how well we're able to reproduce that calibration using the 1 degree per second data, which is reported, and the 2 degree per second data, which we use the 400 to regress out the NASA.
Why
don't
you try with the theory curve always less than the magnitude
of the data? But it is fit. This is the gain here is done globally over many. This
is not a particular fit just to this time stream, so I'm not sure. That's a good question.
Yeah, and this noise level is not certainly consistent with 10%. I mean, this is much better than 10% noise level.
The 10% is a systematic uncertainty. It is not statistical.
Do you know what happened to your instrument that you gave it 1 per second and then goes to 2 per second?
We have searched for various things. The best candidates are atmospheric pendulations and atmospheric noise, which I don't believe because I think the gain is wrong on that. The next best thing is temperature variations in the cold stage or in the object box, which are both very well motivated. But in fact, we have hints, but not anything definite on that might be what's going on. So we are not really confident that what exactly physical is driving this. But we also know that it's a very low frequency, so we can filter it out if we want to put it to the CMB.
While we're driving the motors to accelerate the package,
there's power dissipation in the motors and that kind of thing. And as we slow down the package, we actually recharge the batteries with the motors, it turns out. And so there are those things that are going on. And those accelerations are naturally larger in the QDCS data.
What are the spectrum?
It's larger than the 400 gigahertz, the dipole?
Yeah.
The dipole fits the CMB spectrum. It's very good in the 90s, 150s, and the 240s.
Right,
the scan synchronous stuff in the 2 DPS stuff is stronger at 400 gigahertz.
Right.
That one works really well to
it.
Well, the problem is that they have if it's thermal variation in the cold stage, then it depends on G, right? And so, you know, the 400s have higher G, so they'll be better connected to the cold stage. And they also are more sensitive to the atmosphere. So I think we haven't done a detailed look at what the spectrum compared to expected atmosphere or GDs or those kinds of terms. But I think generally most everything is going to be more sensitive in the 400s. That's going to be the time. Okay, so that's where we get our calibration. We also compare the calibration with point sources. I'll show some pictures of those first. But first, there's the issue of low frequencies versus high frequencies. You know, the fact that we're calibrating at low frequency and then we're measuring the PNB at high frequency. The low frequency thing that's going on in the transfer function of the electronics, et cetera, is just a simple AC roll-off filter. The electronics operate at about the same temperature, room temperature in flight, as it turns out. And also we have a 2 DPS, 1 DPS agreement to 10%, which tells us that we understand the transfer function pretty well. We also test the transfer function with step functions in flight. To understand the high pass, the longer time constant piece of it, this is a diagram here of cosmic ray hits, where we took all the cosmic ray hits above a certain size, or actually within a certain amplitude range in flight, and fit a model that included phase offsets in the cosmic rays and amplitudes of the cosmic rays, and got this nice beautiful envelope, all these dots are from just many, many, many cosmic rays. For each cosmic ray, we get about two samples or so. So this is pretty remarkable. And this is the fit to the impulse response function of the detector with this single time constant model plus the electronics. And you can see that it's a very good fit. And so this is what gives us confidence that we're using the right time constant for that calibration problem.
John,
yeah.
What we find in cosmic rays depends on the time constant, depending on where the cosmic ray is. And that doesn't seem to be the case here. Has that been taken out somehow?
We have, no. This is all cosmic rays with a certain amplitude that's not getting too large, right, and getting close to going down linear. And but yet detected with a high signal of noise. There are some channels where there appears to be something else going on in a small family of them, but most of them
are just being directed.
Yeah, and for some reason we're not getting very many of those. Yeah, it may be the time. Okay, so we also did our calibration on various galactic sources. Tim Kobol's been working very hard on this. Here's some naive maps. These are not MADCAP maps or maximum likelihood in any sense of various sources at various frequencies. This is just to show you that we actually did look at a lot of galactic sources. These have some memory effects in them because the time constant effects are not taken into account completely correctly in these maps. This is just to say that we observed a variety of galactic sources. And for those of you who are galactic aficionados, here's a more beautiful map of of IRAS-OE-576, which is a very, very distinct source in the galaxy with all sorts of little dust clouds around it and everything. I'm going to talk a little bit about getting the beam out of those guys. The fact is, I'll show this. And then taking that source, one of those sources, and binning it radially, the problem is that we're running through with these sources and trying to determine our beam, is that the sources are not really point-like, these galactic sources with dust around them. And so we have to worry about the wings, okay? And also neighboring sources in various directions and that kind of thing. So this is a radial profile binned around some certain piece of the annulus that looks pretty clean in the IRAS maps and in our maps. And you can see here that there's a very good fit to a Gaussian right there. So this is something that gives us confidence about our beam sizes. And also, using those profiles can be used to, along with an observation of that source, a calibrated observation of that source, to again check our calibration. And what we did was that Kim went to the SEST telescope in Chile, and observe some of these sources at 90 to 150 gigahertz. And that is a very small angular scale observation of the core, you know, the sort of central few arcminutes, really. The larger scale that looks at are sort of 8 to 10 arcminutes or something like that. And looking at those fluxes, those calibrated fluxes, and asking whether we get the right amount of flux at 1 sigma and 2 sigma in our beam, we come up with an agreement between those calibrations and our dipole calibrations to within, well, the worst one is of order 15% or something like that. So again, that sort of tells us that we're in the right ballpark for our calibration.
So where is the 10%
flux? What we did was use a whole bunch of different methods, and we looked at the scatter of those various methods and looked at them and said, okay, how confident are we? It's mostly a systematic uncertainty and not a statistically derived uncertainty.
But it doesn't come from the jitter.
The jitter is in there, okay? So what we did was we had various estimates of the jitter. The pointing uncertainty, what I was referring to, is that our pointing model is not perfect yet. It's actually very rough because we rough to solve for it because we do not have a star camera, or we did not in this flight. And so it's a tough job. So this is one of the things we want to improve, but there is some RMS uncertainty in our pointing, which adds into the beam uncertainty. We estimated the pointing jitter based on serendipitous passes through various sources and also the jitter that we saw in single in galactic sources and that kind of thing. The way we actually got our beam was that we took this data right here. What we did was we flew a balloon, a small tethered balloon in Antarctica, and we hung an Echozor ball on Kevlar's rope below it and tethered that to the ground. And then we scanned it with the gondola and made a map of it. Okay? And we used two sizes of balls under here. We call this the balloon ball map. Okay? And we scanned back and forth. One of them was a small ball about the size of a softball, just Echozorb, at 500 yards or something like that. And the other one was a larger, almost basketball-sized thing. And the basketball-sized thing railed. The Echozorb, the small softball-sized one, gave us a good main beam. We get a much better map in azimuth than in elevation because we're able. The azimuth passes are easy to line up and that kind of thing. I don't know where the transparency is. You're probably hating for this. But the fact is that in that map, we get a good estimate of the true physical beam in a slightly near field, though. Okay, and we take that and we scale that beam with a ray optics estimate of the beam or a calculation of the beam via ray optics in the near field and scale it to the far field, which is a small effect, but it's an effect we take into account. And in these maps, we also saw side lobes at the few percent level that agreed with what we expected based on the ray optics. Okay, when I say ray optics, I mean really following phases and point spread function, that kind of thing. And then we scale that again, that also to the far field. And so we have these small lobes on our beam, which are calculated with Vmax. So, for instance, the channel reported in Nature is this guy right here. This is a calculation, right? And it's this lobe right here that we were actually able to see with the balloon ball and say that we really thought it was there. The galactic sources are not clean enough for us to really be confident about anything that's going on at the few percent level, right? This will get much better when we map these galactic sources this coming year with Akbar, which has 4 arcminute beams. We're going to learn a lot more about the galactic sources and then be able to say more about our beams. So this whole procedure, of course, is what we're doing is we're scaling a model from near field to far field and then confirming it with what we do believe from the sources. And that's where we come up with the 10% uncertainty in the beam length. To look at how that affects that, of course, affects our window function, right? And somebody brought up before, how much does it affect our window function dependent on L? Here you can see, that this is for a 10.5 arcminute window function, which is one of our other channels. This is a plot made by Eric Yvonne. If you change the window function to that for a beam, which is off by a half arcminute or an arcminute, you can see that the window function in L of 600 with an arcminute off starts to move by about 10%. So this is the level at which you start getting interested in these things.
And of course, it gets much worse and worse for higher L.
map. I'm sure most of you have seen this before. Just to point out a few things, there is a square right here. This is the piece that we actually report the power spectrum on. The other thing to point out is that this map is actually smoothed to the slightly so that we could show the 90 gigahertz maps and these maps with the same effective smoothed angular resolution. There's a quasar right here, and a quasar right here, which I'll talk about more in a second. Let's see what else. This is also made with several channels, and we only reported the power spectrum on one. We didn't want to worry about correlation, noise correlation. Actually, if you look here, you can see the same thing.
Okay,
so this is a 240 gigahertz map. I'll just play the trick of doing this, okay, just so that people don't say that I'm just looking at noise. So they line up very well. One thing you do notice is that this 240 gigahertz map has the right things right here, but this is a dark box. It's not as a bright 150 gigahertz map. Okay. So these are black sources, or black files off the black plane. This is a 400 gigahertz map, looks like this. This is scaled to a frequency between 150 and 240 gigahertz, somewhere in there. And so here you see the effective brightness that you would expect at that lower frequency from these galactic dust clouds. And you can see out here there's a fair between, except for some stuff in here. And in fact, this is real stuff, real dust stuff, that you can actually see in the soil fire data map. So this is real stuff. It's known at 100 microns and 40 seconds. What we've done is we've gone through and we've looked at the RMS of these maps and determined that, in fact, the dust contribution of 150 gigahertz is about a couple percent. We've measured that as well. Represents about a little bit over 400 square degrees of sky, right? So that box. It's also a power spectrum that comes from one channel. It's our best channel, of course, as Adrian points out. One does not waste one's time on one's worst channel when one is trying to publish. And so this is also inside the box. This is half of the flight, but inside the box we only have 30 hours of data. It took half the flight. A lot of it spent outside the box. This is about 30, 31 hours of data with this counterfeit resolution thing. We get this power spectrum, and then if we split that 30 hours up into the first 15 and the second 15, take the difference map and take the power spectrum of that, then you get the green point. The chi-squared is, the reduced chi-squared is very close to 1. Well, I think it's like 1.1 or something like that.
That's not really a power spectrum, though, right? What is it really?
That is a power spectrum.
It's negative.
What is it? Help me. I mean, if we had the white noise in here, right, it would just be a rising function,
right?
But that's, of course, taking out the noise piece. You're separating the math piece and the noise piece, right?
We don't really say this, we're subtracting noise from what you're doing with the signal.
Yeah.
So if there is no signal, you should get scattering around zero.
Right.
So it's really just subtracting.
Thanks for your second point.
Oh, this is a bad point?
Yeah, have it.
It's the way to interpret F-box, and that if anyone else measures that area of sky, or you measure another channel, that point can't change by, it could be a hundredth or a 50th of the error mark. Because you're going
this is the statistical noise. And this includes cosmic current.
Right.
And it's dominated by cosmic current.
So if physical noise has a particle,
on that same piece of the map, that is statistically what I guess is the...
So you're making that for... you're making that for...
Yes,
you're making up the point all the way up
to
peak and all the way down, and
these are cosmic variations limited in the error bars, in the statistical error bars that are reported, right?
Right, so
you want to talk personally?
No,
this
sounds like a setup.
No. You can come back here like 15 minutes telling us that the map is already launched and they've got the power spectrum. No, I don't think it's the be-all, end-all. I think that we are in a regime here where the data, the statistics on the data are evolving faster than our ability to, deal with the data. And so I really think that this is, Lloyd's looking at me going, what are you talking about? No, but seriously, I think that the fact is that we are starting to say such precise things about the power spectrum, about the cosmology, that I have serious worries about what's going on here. And so, statistics, these are the right statistics and all that kind of stuff, and this is all we've thought about.
In that vein, can I ask another question?
Yeah.
You must have worries about these high L points not looking like this matter very much.
These points right here?
Yeah.
No, I don't worry about that.
What it means is that's the right model.
This model, I should remark on this model. Okay, this model right here is not a best fit to this data.
Right, no, I know.
Right, this model is a best fit to the B97 test flight data, which is, and in fact, the calibration is in there too.
You look at the last 6 points, and even if the power spectrum is flat, I would expect them to scatter.
I hear you. We. Yeah, they have scattered, yeah. Thank you, Lyman.
It's like a tricky thing to do to compare your other channels, especially on the larger angular scale.
Yes.
And I'm wondering,
we're thinking about doing that. I'm really glad you brought that up.
Well, I think about it. It's fun people for a long, long time.
Yeah, no. Of course, we're planning on doing this, and it's in the works right now. In fact, I was going to say a little bit more about this later, if I had time. But the fact is that we're going back and trying to improve our pointing model, do you want to do the other channels? It's just a lot of data to push through. And so we have done some comparisons with other channels, which I'm not telling you about.
Yeah.
Your pointing error in the 9-12 parameter estimation paper?
The beam uncertainty, part of which goes into pointing error, is a big piece of that. Goes into these little correlated, move the top of the error bar up to here, bottom right. Down to here, right? So this correlated shift. That is the error in the window function, right? And so the error in the window function, the window function is partially due to the fact that we use a very coarse pixelization, all right? And also the fact that we have a beam here that's got a finite width. The product of the two gives us a black curve. There's some uncertainty in the window function due to the beam. Right, but in fact, we're getting equal parts of the window function fall off or due to the beam and the pixelization right now.
And that's in the
parameter. The beam uncertainty is in the parameter. Okay.
No, just to test the effect.
How much time is
that? Yeah.
Oh, come on, 5 minutes.
The fact that these points don't move around very much isn't because they're very correlated.
No, they should not be very correlated unless Andrew threw in an extra correlation factor that he refused to tell us about.
The correlation between them is very small.
Paper, so I thought I'd
say what we actually did because it's particularly naive. In other words, I did it. This is the region that we reported the power spectrum on. I took the Wombat catalog, the PMN survey, and Eric Gleiser and Smoot put together. And these are just symbols showing you where all the point sources in that catalog extrapolated to 150 gigahertz. Their positions don't move, but this is where they are. These guys are the bright ones, the ones with little stars on them. That's a medium bright one, and these ones get fainter. The total flux from all these things, 150 gigahertz, is predicted to be that, with an RMS shown. Here's a histogram of the size in our pixel slash mean of these things. The brightest one is, roughly speaking, a few hundred millikelvin, or microkelvin, excuse me. I took that and just made an estimate of its effect on the power spectrum, just using the fact that PL should be constant for a set of point sources, and then of course using this formula for the RMS, so that previous number, the RMS from the previous view graph, set this, get an estimate of CL, then I plot L squared CL here, and what you see is that at 600, an L of 600, we're roughly speaking 150 or so microkelvin squared. That's of order the uncertainty due to our window function uncertainty. Okay, that's sort of approximate size of that.
Okay, so it's in there. You don't like this?
It's
a full time. It's 4.5?
Oh, well, I'm sure I did it right in this, but no, I'm so serious. I had it in there. I know it's right.
It's right in the analysis, but not in the plot.
Okay, so that's all I'll talk about in terms of boomerang and crystals and give you one more minute. I'll talk about where we're going next. Where we're going next is to try and analyze the data better. Obviously, we've only done 30 hours of data on one channel. We want to put together a few more channels to give you an idea of how well we might be able to do. This is the nature power spectrum with some of the underlying benefit models from our parameter estimation team. And then I went and used the age-old Knossian formula for predicting, given our sky coverage and the sensitivity and our beam and all that kind of stuff, the errors that we should have gotten with the various L's. And you can see that, in fact, it's a pretty good mapping from error size here to error size up there. And you notice that these points actually don't spread around the line very much at all. this panel right here is just to give you a little bit of hope that, in fact, the formula actually works, right? So if we take a few more detectors, a little bit more sky coverage, a little bit more time, a little bit smaller pixels, right? Same beam size, but a little bit smaller pixels. This is the kind of uncertainty that we expect to be able to pull out in the next while. So this is where we're going. You can see that the errors are going to improve an awful lot in this regime through here. Out here, I should say that, in fact, this region right here, this is probably over-optimistic because this requires perfect knowledge of the beam to get to this exact level, right? And so our uncertain beam knowledge in that previous plot that I showed with the window function uncertainty as a function of that knowledge is really gonna drive things out in this area right here. So don't be going home expecting us to get a signal-to-noise 2 estimate of the power out at 1,000. That's not something to take in this plot. Instead, just sort of looking at the region and taking a guess at where we might be going.
I'll stop there.
You want 150 gigahertz?
With the full mass of the boomerang, the full, okay, the bigger one, bigger, the one that includes the galaxy type. Where you
mean the coverage?
Yeah, the full, coverage.
Okay, but now there's no signal there.
Yeah, I know, but I just wanted to look at that one.
Okay, if I can find it, I'll show it to you, but you can go ahead and answer the question to them. Oh, yeah, you can use it. Okay.
Not that one, but the one that shows like how
what rational. Oh, I see the one with the IRS map at the bottom.
Yeah.
It's in here. Also from there. So if I had PowerPoint, I'd be able to do this with that. All right.
Yeah, sure. Now the reason we didn't scan further left, at the far left edge, was because we're worried about getting signal from the front.
Yes.
Now, so what was the reason that you didn't spend more time on the left half of the map? So was there some reason that you mapped
the galaxy? Okay, so this galaxy line right here actually shoots right up through here, right? So basically, look, we got high signal and noise over this whole region, right? We wanted to cover as much of the sky as we could without getting nailed by the sun, basically.
You're getting confident in the opposite of more than the last. You want to get a scan for
company crafted in those days.
But if we did have a different time of day, we would.
Well, I think most of the company has been at half.
We did what we could within the constraints of the sun and staying away from the galaxy for 1.4. That's really good. So, we really have to get through it.
I'll do better next time.
We think that we'll be able to do sort of an order even for degree for the
I don't want to commit to doing much more than that without more thought. Yeah, Matt.
Sorry if I missed that, but did you not count the brightest point source when you did that?
You did not miss that. No. And the deal is that if you look at my estimates due to the point sources, right?
What happens if you mask out the brightest three point sources, it goes down, the contribution goes down by a factor of two or so. And so they are probably contributing an order, 75 to 100 microkelvin at L of 600. Thank you. That was all bad with exponents.